DJ, welcome to the Tech Sales Mentors podcast.
Hi, John Doe. Pleased to be here.
Where does this podcast find you today?
I am in the midst of a career break. I'm absolutely having a ball. So I finished up in my last employer just before the Easter break and taking a bit of a break, John Doe, just refreshing, rebuilding knowledge, I suppose, in some textbook and classroom learning. Listening to podcasts and spending time with the family, and going to be doing a bit of traveling.
So, fantastic.
Pretty happy at the moment.
You mentioned offline that you were taking a real break with some emphasis on the real. Tell me more about that.
It's been a bit of a stretch. I've had a 15-year stretch going from one to the other in some fairly high-pressure environments. Lots of great fun, lots of great learning, but you know, reach a certain point where your learning starts to plateau a little bit and you're struggling to find the right kind of mentors and coaches to take you to that next level. Put all of that together, plus post-COVID, all the transformation that's been going on in the market. It's a really good time to take a break and to take stock. I feel like I need to do some learning as well and some refresh and take care of well-being for me to be ready for that next challenge, right? And so, I'm really looking forward to this next stage.
What's been different about, you mentioned learning and finding a mentor, what's been different about that at this stage of your career?
Well, if I think back over, I've had a good 20-year run, to be honest with you. I'm pretty pleased with what I've learned and what I've done, but I certainly didn't do it off my own back. You know, there was great peers around me, there was great coaches, great managers. And you know what? Some not so great ones as well, because you learn from them all. But what happens is, as you get to a certain level, the number of people that you're learning from gets infinitely smaller, you know, and you tend to be the one that suddenly you look around and you're like, who am I going to? And you realize everyone's going to you, or a lot more people going to you than, you know, would normally. And suddenly you need to make sure that you're staying ahead of the curve in that regard too. And that gets harder and harder the longer you go, I guess. And so, being able to step back and reflect on some of the things you have learned, some of the things I should have done differently, better, and some of the things I did really well that, you know, perhaps didn't yield the results that we wanted to, and some of the things that just worked perfectly. And when you reflect on those things, you take up the learning, it makes me a better mentor and a coach for others that I'm speaking to.
Could you share what resources that entails for you and what process it entails going to find a mentor?
Well, funnily enough, like podcasts is a big thing for me. I do like to read, but I tend to prefer reading books that are relevant to what I'm doing right now. So, for example, I always go back to Seven Habits and Challenger Sales. Those kind of books tend to always be foundational in that regard. Outside of that, I really do like listening to podcasts in terms of what's current and what's right now. I'm a big fan of the mindfulness things. Some of those books like not giving a shit about what's going on out there and just focusing on yourself, those kind of books. Trying to be politically correct here, John Doe, but you know, I find that's really important, particularly, you know, when you're going through high periods of pressure or taking a break like I am right now, that mindfulness. And then finally, I just signed up to Pavilion recently as well. So with Sam Jacobs Group, yeah, we've put some good context in there together. So I'm enjoying just meeting people from different industries, selling different things, working in different parts of the customer journey. That's helping. And they've got some great courses in the background of things that just help round out knowledge and bounce and challenge some of the thinking that I've had over the 3 years. So all feeding in. Of course, yeah, I've got an 18 and a 16-year-old that give you different coaching and mentoring challenges too. So,
sure. It's 360, no doubt. And the mindfulness, if I can ask, is that grounded in any type of school of philosophy or spirituality? Is it science-based?
Not really. Conceptually, it's just about anything, really. It's just finding look, my personal values all built around being able to sleep at night, right? And so as a constant, while taking on the sales team, you know, there's a few philosophies and beliefs that I prescribe to. One of them is you've got to be able to sleep at night. What does that mean? It means that we all have an internal moral compass about how we treat other people, our family, our friends, our customers, etc. And, you know, you want to live up to those every day and therefore be able to sleep at night. And so, yeah, I suppose that's centered around balance. you know, being well balanced as an individual, at one with world, with your organization, with your peers, with your family, and understanding the balance that. But look, we're in tech sales. We're highly privileged to earn what we do for what we do and what we put back into society, right? And so once you value that, well, then it changes your perception on how you give back to the community that we're part of and the broader society in which we live.
And no doubt that changes throughout the various stages of your life, I'd imagine. Can you recall a key use of that philosophy for your reps throughout your career, maybe younger reps? What is it? What's the challenge that they typically have where you've used that philosophy as to you've got to be able to sleep at night?
Well, you know, especially with the younger reps, right? They tend to have found their way into sales because of the part of the end of the rainbow, right? They're coming in there seeing the big commission checks and the glory that comes with making club and those kind of elements. And look, there's no one particular vendor that's worse or better at this than others. It's, you know, you get through the NASDAQ and pretty much all of those have had some kind of boiler room experience on their sales floor, you know, across the spectrum overall, right? And so, you know, grounding that and finding those reps to actually understand the value of what they're doing, you know, understand that they have personal values themselves, and then translating that to their customer buyer journey is what I look for in talent, to be honest with you. I'm not looking for, I'd much rather have someone sitting between, say, 85 to 110% who's doing it the right way with values and has a well-balanced life, as opposed to someone who's scorching the earth and banking 180 to 200% committing for.
Interesting. And we'll dive into that in a bit more detail a bit further in the chat. But let's go through your track record and maybe introduce you a little bit more formally, Vijay, for those who don't know. So you've served as head of sales for an Australian unicorn, Wallex. More recently, you were VP sales at a prominent finance software firm in Blackline, and you're taking a small break at the moment. You spent 8 years with NetSuite, finishing as senior sales director for Japan and Asia Pacific. During that time, managing up to 85 staff, consistent overachievement, quarter on quarter growth, around $100 million in recurring revenue accountability, and opening up new geographies. Now, firstly, tell me, what is Club Evil?
So Club Evil was something that was founded in NetSuite, and it was a time when if a rep was to make $1 million, it was quite an impressive feat, bearing in mind this was in the early 2000s, when the cloud was still emerging and so on. And so as time evolved, it really became where the top 10 sellers worldwide of NetSuite were recognized. And it was like a special club for the ultimate achievers. I made that twice, which was pretty impressive. It's a really special environment, actually, because you get the club, which is where your president's club, your 100% achievers go. This recognized the top 10 sellers worldwide. You tend to get some really good engagement with the C-suite and some senior executives and some real high-touch coaching that continued outside of that environment. Yeah. And so those relationships and those skills still are valuable for me today.
And it was a really massive journey, obviously really well-known and revered. During that time, NetSuite was acquired by Oracle, and it was the third largest ever acquisition in tech at that time. So over the 8 years, I mean, can you describe what that journey was like for you, what the highs and the work involved looked like?
You know, so it's an interesting one. When I talk about NetSuite, there's almost two stories at NetSuite. There's the pre-acquisition and there's the post-acquisition. So pre-acquisition, you know, we were moving really well in what we were doing and growing quarter on quarter anyway. During that time when, you know, we were still building out that commercial space, they had the machine in place and so on. But we didn't really have the ecosystem to scale to the levels that we wanted to. And so I started in Australia in that part of the business. And then as we started to gain more momentum, we moved to a more structured model, created a commercial sales team, which I ran. And then with the Oracle acquisition, that was almost like private equity rather than an acquisition. And especially in those first 2.5, 3 years where they really just put in a significant amount of money into the business, to enable us to scale to a level that we weren't able to before. You know, I won't put the business under. I won't share any confidential information, but there was a time where we just absorbed 40 additional reps across the region overnight, and we brought them into the business. We scaled them up and got them field ready and effective and brought into the machine that was NetSuite. And you can see that in the results. That is still sort of dialing inside of Oracle, still growing 35% year on year. Some of those fundamentals that happened in those times are still what's driving and scaling the business today. But yeah, really exciting time. You talk about the Hive. Honestly, I would say, the vast majority of it was Hive. It was a fantastic time and place to be. And I'm blessed to have had that as part of my journey.
You mentioned the PE type approach. Would you describe that journey as being quite organic in the way you grew? And second to that, if so, do you feel like there's been somewhat of a change in the industry in the available opportunities like that to do it in that way versus the hyper growth models that we see more commonly now?
Well, okay, it's funny actually. So the experiences that I had with the Oracle investment into NetSuite was not dissimilar to the experiences I had when I joined AirWallet. And I think that actually set me up quite nicely for there. Because again, it was a similar thing. We're opening up a geography at NetSuite. So, okay, well, here's the mass investment to go do it at scale. There's no point doing it in ones and two. And AirWallet was very similar. We wanted to scale up that commercial piece, which is why I came on board. And yeah, that was the remit that Neil gave me at that time, which was, we want to scale up the Australian business. And so we did it really, really quickly. We hired 25, 28 people in the space of 12 months. Yeah. And so those experiences were pretty similar in that regard, right? It was like, people are putting an investment and they need a return back. What shifted, I think, now is, things like the Rule of 40, the real focus on CAC and profitability, you're finding a distinctly different behavior for investor-led businesses in that. Let's get to profitability. Let's look at what the efficiency is and drive that in a much more measured way.
Is there anything that you've changed in the way that you build go-to-market sales organizations, bearing in mind what you just mentioned? What are the key things that you change typically?
As a sales leader, you tend to be dancing to the tune of the business to a degree in terms of what the outputs are that they're after. And then the resources that you need. And then really it's a case of how much that investment looks like for future years. Both with NetSuite and with AirWallet, the investment of adding in 25 people in one go, the expectation wasn't that they're all going to be hitting their quotas and be hitting their targets in the next 3 months and then being successful in that immediate year. That's just not realistic. What you're doing, however, is you're building up that mass for years two and three. And so from a go-to-market perspective, it wasn't unusual for me to be having a forecast a year out, maybe 2 years out. And therefore, that investment was built on that. By the same token, when you're working in those hyper-growth, fast-growth companies where there's a highly strategic imperative on the investment, it's not unusual to have that same conversation go to what's the forecast for this month as well. And so that elasticity of thinking, is very dynamic and very exciting. But again, bringing back into some of the businesses today, the thinking hasn't changed in terms of, what's your forecast for this month? What's your forecast for 3 years? The investment and the structure around it has potentially tempered a little bit. Like, how do we get more bang for the buck? How do we ensure people are successful and engaged? And we could talk about that as we go as well, because the human behavior and the generational shift have had an impact on that too. So it's not just the marketplace as well. But you can see, the investors, the returns they're getting and the valuations they're seeing in the market are forcing a more prudent approach to grow and the efficiency of the investments they're making.
So it sounds
like that change for me as a sales leader, it's really, the productivity of the people that you're getting. As a sales leader, it's giving me more time to spend with individuals. And if I look at Blackline, for example, we didn't do the here's 20 people, let's go and don't blow out the region. Hey, let's be a little bit more measured with this. Let's work with the people, understand the bulk of the problem that we're looking to address and create, create quality sellers over time. And not to say that the others didn't, but it was, a much more measured approach. And so that's probably the shift for me, the benefit for me personally was I love working with sales reps and sales leaders and coaching or making them better. And so a wonderful opportunity to do that.
When you're a sales leader assessing a new opportunity within your organization, it sounds like, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like there are almost two distinct go-to markets that, you know, are available in market. One is here and one looks like this. And the latter one is where you can ensure reps are set up for success, spend time and look at a 1 and year two, year two forecast as well as the monthly. And another is very hyper growth, maybe some churn, just do things really, really quickly. Is it the case that when you're looking for an opportunity as a sales leader, that those two type of opportunities exist and you basically pick whether you'd want to do that kind of go to market?
There is that. And it's the same for the reps as well, right? It's not hard these days to find information on the organization, right? Like one of the top tech companies in the world, you see it every year, there'll be a bunch of redundancies and then a bunch of hiring. And you just follow that cycle. As a rep, as a manager, as a leader, yeah, if you know that going in, you're going in with your eyes open, you're choosing to be in that environment because you're seeing something there, you know, that makes that risk worthwhile. You know? And
yeah.
There is a distinct culture that sits in those types of organizations, and there's a distinct skill set that sees people succeed in certain environments over others. And I think that's down to the individual to assess what kind of environment do I thrive in and understanding that.
What was the culture like at NetSuite during those years?
You know what, with NetSuite, you want to look at it and there's that maxim, right? That people will perform to the lowest common denominator, as opposed to elevated to the highest common denominator, right? And I was fortunate in that the space that I was operating in, I had a bunch of skills from my background that enabled me to perform well. It was all working for me. And so the group that I was with, we tended to see continued success. And so what you tended to have was a really high, lowest common denominator. You know, the lowest performer in my group was probably in the 70th percentile. Yeah. Compared to other business units that may have been in a 30 to 50% range. And so what that meant was there was a certain expectation that came with being in my unit. There was a certain belief that came in, you know, and I think that culture kind of fleshed right through the organization that I was responsible for and gave that level of extra effort, extra commitment, extra success. And because people were consistently seeing the rewards, you got that performance. It was a genuinely high performance culture.
And when you are hiring in smaller volume, you can ensure that you're hiring, you know, plus 70% is basic, can't you? But it gets more and more difficult when you're hiring a lot of people in a short period of time, and that bar for talent has to balance quality versus speed. Would you attribute that culture due to hiring really well and taking a longer view on outcomes and NetSuite? Is that why you managed to have performance culture?
Yeah, look, there's always those various elements that play into it. One of the things I learned from mistake is you're not hiring on results, you've got to hire the character. Yeah. So I'd always say I hire the character and train the skills and max them. I learned from experience rather than a book in that regard. And it was very much a case of someone could have performed somewhere else. They may have had a quarter lucky year, you know, a couple of lucky years, right? It could have been right economic conditions. But to actually be successful in sales, there's a certain character that's required. You've got to be resilient. Yeah, you know, salespeople, you know, you're picking up the phone, if you're thinking about prospecting, you're going to fail 99% of the time. There's not many careers where you're asking someone that for the first 2 years of what they do in this career to be successful, you're going to fail 95% of everything that you do.
Right? How did you go about it?
I know girls that are actually understanding that they understand why that is, understanding the effort required to get to that. They value the 5% that does come through a success. And they understand, you know, that ringing the bell at the point is not where the hard work is, right? The hard work goes in before. One of the lines I tell my kids in the the team that I'm involved with in the park and so on. I said, like, discipline is required to get you to where you need to be, because discipline is doing the thing that you don't want to do so you can do the thing that you want to do. Yeah. And in the sport field, that's the training, right? That's all the hard work that goes on in the training field in the background, at home doing the video reviews, the fitness in the gym. That means that when you take the field in the game, when it matters, over that 90 minutes or whatever it is, you can perform at your optimal level. And it's no different to sales. Most of the work happens in the background and on the ground. And so you get that one moment to ring that bell.
How do you assess the resilience?
I've been told I'm a pretty tough interviewer. I'm not sure I am. I feel I'm a bit nicer than that. But look, there is a process you go through during the interview where you are looking at what are the aspects and how people prepare for the interview, how they address the questions in the interview. You can put people under pressure in an interview and pull out some of those things. Obviously, experience comes through. You can talk to some of those life experiences. Look, for me, I look for, I don't know too much about others, to be honest with you. I look at the textbook elements of their skills. How many years have they done? What have they done? And some of their deals. I do look for the human behaviors and characteristics outside of it. What are they doing outside of the job? Yeah. What is the why? As Senek said, right? You know, you got to explore the why. I think it's absolutely critical in sales, especially when you're hiring people in that younger generation, and especially right now, that generational shift, right? Why are you doing this? What is your need that you're trying to fulfill with a career in sales? You know, and it's no different to a deal, by the way. Okay, you're always going to chase the nose, right? Why do you want to be in sales? You know you're going to fail 95% of every time you pick up that phone. Are you sure you want to do this? Yeah. And you weed out and get those people who are, you know, who genuinely want to do this because they understand that sales is what they were born to do. And this is what I want to do. Or I'm going to work really hard to be a professional seller. So some of those thinking, no, I just want this outcome. Oh, and you can sense that. Some of that's experience. Some of it's just the right questions and knowing where to dig, I suppose.
Yeah,
and the benefit of hiring 30, 40 people en masse, I guess you're going through significant chunks of that process. So you get to evaluate people. But we don't always get it right. I certainly don't always get it right. I made some hires that I wasn't sure about that turned out to be fantastic. I made some hires. I was sure they were going to nail it, knock it out of the park, and they just didn't fire. And so it's crazy. There was one time I was running an inside sales desk out of the West Coast in the US. And the philosophy in the US is very, very different. And that was a proper boiler room, man. I had, I had to hire 5 new people every month. And so I'd fly over and bring in these 5 new people. What I also had to do was let 2 people go from the previous cohort. It didn't matter what the performance was like. So all 5 could have absolutely nailed it, but I had to let 2 go. And so one of those textbook American cultural things that you see, right? And it was tough, but it built that skill of really understanding people and why and the whys and the drive required.
And that legacy of NetSuite's hiring approach remains to the day. If I see somebody that's worked at NetSuite, I always want to talk to them. By and large, every rep that I talk to that's worked at NetSuite, they tend to be really good. I'm always impressed when I speak to NetSuite reps. There's a certain character about them, if I could talk to it, and just they tend to be quite self-aware and quite mature, hardworking. They always tend to do well in interviews, basically, if they come from NetSuite. So there's obviously something in the water there that's creating great reps. Let's talk about that time. So during your 8 years, you had a 95% employee retention rate, very high for technology sales. You also had the highest number of promotions in the region and the highest percentage of quota carriers recognized in President's Club. which tells me, you know, a lot about how to incentivize and motivate young people, because a lot of that cohort would be young. What effects of the generational shifts are most obvious to you in analyzing your sales teams in recent years versus 5-10 years ago?
So, you know, it's interesting. Further back, it's kind of the early moment that we touched on in the generational shift, right? There used to be a case of, I'm chasing the dollar. I need to be successful in my career. You know, I want to buy a house. I've got to hustle in and kids I want to run with. I am very big on the balance from culture, age, gender, etc. And so, you know, you tend to get the right mix of those as well. But the common belief was that drive to achieve towards something. Where I found more recently that generational shift is towards that personal success. Yeah, you know, I want to achieve. I want to be successful for me. You know, I want to work in a good environment where I'm learning and I'm developing. I'm working with good technology, and that's a shift that started. That's going to continue, I think. I was hypothesizing barbecue conversation, right? Which was that the generation now coming through into sales in their early to mid 20s, yeah, their dreams of owning a home are further away. And they're seeing people who are taking on $1 million mortgages and going to be tied down for 30 years. And they're thinking, I don't necessarily want to be doing that. Yeah. I want to enjoy what I'm doing. And it's almost gone 360. They're actually, you know, the sellers that are kind of, you know, I think are going to be in a position to be extremely successful. Because what you've got the generation that came through that sold by process. So particularly during COVID, right? But really good at selling online. And, you know, you had the whole selling via email and all of those kind of assets. Because that whole shift now, the current sellers who are starting up the process are used to having conversations. They're passionate about what they do because they're choosing to do what they do. They care about the technology they're doing. They take pride in their success. And I'm finding that, you know, if you focus on those elements of the sales people and particularly your BDRs, and you're hiring them based on that characteristics where they, you know, where they're still bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and they can start to, you know, they're coming with that natural energy, and you can harness that. I think you can really build a next generation of sales professionals, which will change and refresh our industry, I think, to be honest, because there's a bunch. Currently, there's an inordinate number who are used to selling by email, selling by text. You know, doing this because I have to. I've got to meet a mortgage payment. And so you really have to work that much harder to find the salespeople that are doing it because they are passionate about the industry, as in the sales industry, right? The career path. And that's important to me. I hate it when people say, oh yeah, car sales guy. No. I take great pride in the way selling equity and selling structurally and doing all of those things. And I insist on that from the people that I work with. And I'm finding that the next generation of sellers coming through right now aligned to that very, very well.
Interesting. Do you think that could limit the volume of new entrants into the sales industry, bearing in mind if the dream of a house purchase by means of sales success just becomes more distant? Do you think we're going to lose some volume into the industry because of that?
Well, you know what? We are still humans, and we're still a consumer. We're still consumed by consumerism in that regard. So the house is disruptively being replaced with travel, with, you know, the faster car, the nicer clothes, the, you know, the fancy watch, whatever it is. I don't think life ambitions have stopped, but I think they are a little bit more immediate. Yeah. If you scroll through Instagram, you can kind of see what people tend to be looking at, for example, right? It is more experience based than it is ownership of asset based. And so, you know, I know a great number of sellers who are in their late 20s, early 30s have put away an inordinate amount of money. They could buy a house, take on a mortgage, but they're choosing not to do that because their lifestyle means that they don't want to be tied down to that. They've got a better use of their funds. And, you know, I did look at one book, this was the 100-year life, and I'd encourage people to have a look at that because conceptually the person who's going to live to be 100 is already gone. And if you think about, you know, 50 years ago, you know, you studied for 20 years, you worked for 40, you retired at 60, you maybe lived for 15 more years, yeah, and you clocked out at 75. Now what we're saying, though, is you're probably, and that, by the way, in 40 years, you probably worked for one employer, maybe two. But now that's completely shifted. First of all, you know, we're entering the workplace a little bit late, so degrees are running longer. People are taking those breaks. Then you got, you know, retiring, and if you're going to be living into your 90s, you're going to have a different lifestyle about what you want to do. 75, 80 years old, you may still want to be running around Italy or Vietnam and touring different parts of the world. That wasn't the case 50 years ago. That's going to take more money. And so, you know, I can see the mentality of the people I'm talking to. I don't want to be doing this for 50 years.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's a really interesting concept. But you know what, John Doe, the fundamental belief I come back to that works for me is understanding the person and the why. I understand that these sellers may not stay with me for 20 years. They may not stay with me for 5 years. But the commitment I make to anyone I hire is, for the time that you're with me, you will get better. And you will do better. And you will leave better. And I think if you focus on the individual and helping them be better in the skills that they're building and the role that they're doing, hopefully they do it with you. But if not, at least they'll do it somewhere in the world in what they've learned. And I think that's why you find some of the NetSuite people, you know, continue to be successful, because that philosophy, you know, was pushed through quite broadly.
What do you think about what effect that is having on tenures, for instance? Because I think it's fair to say that as a salesperson, staying somewhere for a period of time and building your skill set is ultimately how you get the most reward, be it financially and be it via, you know, career satisfaction. And we know that tenures have dropped, and you know, you're looking at a year to 2 years for an average sales rep right now. Can you talk about the effects and impact there? Is it a bad thing? Is it, you know, is it less relevant these days? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the last 5 years have kind of thrown a spanner in the works on any data points, to be honest with you, because you had the COVID piece. People probably stayed longer than they wanted to or left faster than they were expecting to. Then you had the bump after COVID where, you know, businesses were flush, and so they, you know, were able to hire en masse with some great, great reward structures. And then you had the, you know, pay the piper time, which meant that a lot of those had to disappear as well. And there's also certain employees that carry a certain brand, unfortunately. That means that, you know, people see it on the CV and they know, okay, if they keep in from there, that's understandable. I know why you didn't last there long, you know. So I think you put all of that into the mix. Yeah, tenure is a lot less important than it used to be. I think, you know, as a hirer or sales professional, I look at what did they learn from the experiences, and use that as a way to guide through into the, what is it you actually want to do. And it comes back to the same thing again, right? What is it they actually want to do? Yeah. And I remember myself, I've been in some tough situations, particularly younger in my career. Like, you know, and I was just waiting and pushing and knocking on doors, hoping someone would give me a chance. And so maybe that's why that's the character I'm looking for. Someone who really wants it, saying, give me a chance. I'll give you a chance. Come find me.
Now, that type of salesperson, this new generation we're talking about that, are really high performing, and you've mentioned it, some of those people are earning really well right now. So it's not the case that by and large the industry is not paying well. There's a lot of really financially secure people that are 20 to 30 in SaaS sales right now, and they're going to be the people that SaaS businesses really want to hire. Can we talk about how to do that? This generation we're talking about, and I know flippantly we're talking generations, but young people in the workplace, the things we just talked about, how do we incentivize them and nurture them and set them up for success? Because it's going to be competitive to hire those people. What do you think they need and want right now that you would be offering them, or a SaaS organization should be offering them?
Hello. One of the reasons I like the younger organizations, right? So, you know, obviously I'm on a break, I want to come back in, I'll be looking in those in a Series A, Series B type organizations, is the opportunity to actually make a difference. And so, you know, if you are a young seller, they don't want to just come in and do their job and leave. Is the experience I've had anyway, that they actually want to be part of it. Well, they see a problem, they want to be part of solving it. You know, and it could be as simple as, this field in the CRM is just useless, so hard to click through every time. All right, we'll go and fix it. To, you know, a larger corporate business that's been around 40 years might say, well, that's tough shit. That's the way we've done it. And it's not changing. You know, and I think that's that element there. The second piece is the exposure and the learning aspect. Yeah. Again, in that smaller, younger companies, you're going to really want to dive in and learn those things and get those experiences. We're quite lucky in Australia, by the way, Andre, that we do actually get a lot more exposure. You look at some of those other mass markets, like in the US, for example, people tend to be buttonholed into a very specialist skill set. And they go deep into that skill set and do it over and over. Whereas we just don't have the capacity and the resources over here to do that from just purely from a P&L perspective, right? And so you tend to have a broader responsibility anyway, which I think creates an entrepreneurial spirit in our sellers anyway to do more. We create more problem solving as a natural outcome of that. And I think that continues to permeate through the younger reps who want to come through, they want to learn, they want to experience, they want to make changes. And you know what? They want to move faster and you're more likely to get a promotion in 18 months at a smaller company and be part of that journey than you are in a large company as well. So I think really what you'll find in those younger companies, maybe ones that haven't necessarily taken on mass funding, right? Because they provide different challenges, of course. But yeah, I think that's kind of seeing an environment of those who are invested in learning and developing and having their eye on a longer term development, I think will be highly successful over the next 7 to 15 years.
Yeah, and to quote some stats from a recent report on this generation we're talking about, Hybob, a software vendor in HR and benefits, put together a survey of over 1,000 people in SaaS in Australia, and 14% of their ideal said their ideal company to work for was making a positive difference to the world. 21% would be creating innovative technology. So that lends itself to what you're talking about there. They want to try find some meaning in the work they're doing. And it sounds like it's incumbent upon the hiring manager to work out what that is, because not every business is, you know, creating green technology that will save the world ultimately, but it's about how do you find what's driving that person and spending the time to make a plan to help them get there through the organization. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they're looking for people to invest in them, not just financially but holistically, you know. And I know a lot of people complain about the next generation and their work ethics and so on. I got to tell you, I've not had that experience, you know. I found it's great. You know, they're highly engaged, they're highly intelligent, they're well thought in those regards. And if you put them in an environment where you nurture some of those skills, I find some fantastic talent in that space, you know. And I think they want to make their world better and know that their world impacts the broader world. And that ties in with my personal values, to be fair, in terms of, you know, on those kind of aspects of it. I think my leadership natural style tends to be more outcome-based as well. So I'm not one to sit at your desk from 9 to 5. I never have been, to be honest with you. I remember one of my employees, they were very adamant that, well, no, you don't leave until you've done your clock. And then as soon as I was running some of the sales teams there, I said to one of the guys, what are you doing here? He goes, what do you mean? I said, didn't you have your kids assembly this afternoon? And you could see the emotion come through because he'd never been given that opportunity before. And it's just, you know, my parent myself, I stayed at home with my kids when they were young. Yeah, it's a different, I just think those values are important, you know?
It's a change in mindset because a lot of the people who are running these organizations are from a different generation, right? And the people we're talking about maybe have different priorities. Use case example, myself, anecdotally, I'm 33, and I still have the same competitive approach that I did 5 years ago. But at the same time, I've got two kids under two, and I do bath time and bed every night. I don't miss that. And I think that's something that maybe previous generations wouldn't have done. Can you talk about how because you also took a career break. You mentioned when you had your children. Can you talk about that experience and what impact it had on you as a father, but also on your career as well?
Look, firstly, it's great that they're taking the time out for the family, right? I say that to absolutely everyone. You know, it's no one ever says, I wish I spent more time at work. It's right afterwards, you know, when the time comes. And I think, and by the way, parents, tip for anyone who's a parent of young kids or so on, the iPhones, the mobile phone cameras are killing your long-term memories that you can create. So either use an iPhone, get a camcorder or a GoPro and leave it there and leave it recording for 30, 40, 50 minutes of the kids doing stuff. I guarantee you when your kids are older, you're going to love it. I'm doing that right now. Love watching some of the videos from when the kids were 18 months old and just watching them be. But look, for me, for myself, JJ, when my kids were young, yeah, I've got to be honest, it wasn't by design. It was the GFC. I couldn't find, I was part of a redundancy, had another role in a finance organization that obviously didn't hire during the GFC and the offer got withdrawn. I said, well, you know what? I've done well over the last few years. I want to spend some time with the kids. And so I did, and my wife was working, so she continued to work. And it was a fascinating insight when I reflect back. Like, I took the kids to, you know, baby classes, and some of the moms would be very cheeky. Like, well, why are you here? Quite often I'd get a case of, oh, is it mum's day off? Don't you have a job? And it was it's really interesting because we really focused on the gender balance of supporting women back into the workplace. And I don't think we're doing enough the other way around to push men out of the workplace to do what's important and support that too. You know? And so it was eye-opening in that regard, which is why maybe it just triggered something on me. Right? I always make sure that if there are any dads involved, especially young ones in the workplace that I'm with, I really do force that. It's important. And I'm glad that that's changing in the workplace both ways, right? In terms of welcoming back mothers into the workplace and adapting to that, but also supporting dads to be involved in their family lives as well. But quite frankly, JJ, I think it makes us better managers, better professionals.
What's the best way that can be encouraged? Is it about organizations putting resources towards parental leave? Is that, I mean, it sounds like a straightforward one, but what else?
You know what? Honestly, intent. It's my favorite word over recent times, and I use it with the kids. I use it with my sales reps. I use it with myself. You know, you can say the words, you can put down the laws, you can put down the rules, you know, but ultimately it comes down to what is the intent. Like, the company can say, hey, we've got a great parental policy, but if the intent of the organization is we've got to do that so we can recruit the right people, that's not the right intent. Yeah, we want a family-based environment where people feel comfortable that they can come in and earn money and do the right thing for our customers so they can spend time with their loved ones. You know, that's intent. Yeah. I just think that really permeates through the business. And yeah, if you are looking to change employer, look for the intent. You know, people pick their managers, they leave their managers, but there is an organizational culture shift. And you know what? At NetSuite, we've talked a little about NetSuite, right? The culture of NetSuite was consistent. And it's why you can talk to someone from NetSuite. And for the most part, they understand what the culture was and how to be part of it and all of that, because it was built up there. So, you know, Evan, through Zach, through Jim McGeever, Mark Huffman, you know, these guys created this value chain that permeated through the organization globally. And it was a force for good, you know. By the same token, you can easily find those organizations that say the right things, but are not so much a force for good. And the advice I'd give to people is, when you're looking at the jobs, is I understand we all need to work. We all need to pay bills and keep food on our table. But, you know, if you can, to the best will that you can, is make sure you're joining an organization and take that time to interview them as much as they're interviewing you, to understand that this is the right place for me. Doesn't mean it's going to work out, guaranteed. Things change, but you know, at least you're going in with the intention that you're picking the right organization.
There's an art to doing that, VJ, as you know, even greater than I. In that, sometimes I talk to, you know, my junior reps about doing this, and with all their, you know, intent and just desire to find out those things, they can frame it in the wrong way, which can basically piss off the hiring managers, right? So if they're you going in, it's your first interview, and you're asking them, why should I work here? what I'm trying to explain is you need to do that, but you need to get to a place within that interview process where you have leverage and you're doing it in a way that has some finesse to find out those answers. Do you have any advice for people as to go and find out the answers and do the research and what they might be asking an organization?
When you asked earlier, is that how you were assessing? Communication is one of the strongest skill sets you need. The other one is, of course, planning, right? All the stuff you do in the background and preparation that comes with it. Those are things that you can assess during the sales interview process by the way that question is asked. If someone says, well, why should I work here? That's not worded very eloquently and not worded as a way that sounds like that. It's the same thing as going to a customer and saying, why should I sell you my software? Why should I give you the privilege of buying what I'm selling? It's not, it's not the right question, right? And so, first of all, you want to prepare, understand, is this the right organization? What is the concerns about it? What do you like about it? Yeah. Why do you want to work there? What's the value prop that you're bringing? And what gets the best out of you? Because I think what's happened is, we try and look for a quick win. Ask these interview questions. And Glassdoor is terrible at that. I hate it. These are the questions. And so people prepare the answer. And what happens is you've got an interviewer on the other side who's just been given ask these questions. And so what tends to happen is no one's actually gaining anything from their situations. I mean, why do we interview? It's not a test. It's a way to understand, what have you done to help you develop your skills that I could use over here in this business? And so it really should be a conversation, right? So there's a responsibility on both sides of this. For me, I will read every CV. I'll go onto the LinkedIn. I'll do a Facebook search, all the usual. I'll do a background check effectively to just not a deep one, but just 5 to 10 minutes on every candidate that I interview. And I've done a lot of interviews, but I'll do it every single time because, they're going to invest an hour with me and they're going to share some insights about themselves. The least I can do is be respectful of that and do the same and know enough about them. As the interviewee, though, you want to do that much more. One of the first questions I asked AJ was, how did you prepare for this interview? What do you know about me? What do you know about our customers? Because if they haven't bothered to do that, well, then how much do they really want to be here? Also, I wouldn't dismiss someone on the back of it, but it does. First of all, it sets an expectation. What do I expect from people who work for me? And second of all, it gives me an insight into who's naturally thinking about it that way. And the reason why I say that, JJ, is because what happens is when you're then asking the question, why could I work here? So, I really like the way as an organization you do this for your people. Can you tell me how you actually do that in real life? How does that apply to your team? If you're looking at the parental leave, how much parental leave do you have? No, you can find out how much they have on their website, on Glassdoor or anywhere else. I understand you guys offer a really good parental leave program. That's pretty exciting. Can you help me understand how that's been successful for other sales reps? How have they come back and still been able to perform and hit their numbers?
And the way the best reps are able to do this when they're interviewing, and my advice to those listening is that you've really got to qualify your time. Don't take every interview available to you if you're not sold on the business. Do research beforehand, and the recruiter is going to try give an interview into an interview because they've got to create a pipeline, but the best reps say no to a lot of things. That'd be my experience. People that I'm headhunting, they say no to a lot of things, and then when they are interested in something, they really commit to it. Maybe they've got a couple of opportunities, but they really over prepare and they just blitz the process because they're so prepared versus others, and they treat that like they would a massive prospect. So particularly now, really be conscious about where you're spending your time. Don't spread yourself too thin with interviews that you just go in for a conversation, commit to it or don't, is basically my advice right now. We're almost out of time and I know we could talk forever. There's so much wisdom that I want to get from you, Vijay, but I wanted to touch lastly before we go on your journey in sales. You've got kids that going to be going into the workforce in some years, and you're obviously passing a lot of advice to them. What were the primary influences and decisions that you feel have led you to the career point that you're at now?
So, gosh, there's a couple of tough ones in there. But I kind of look at it and say for myself, I like to be challenged. I like to succeed. And success for me is usually through other people. I've been fortunate in that I have been recognized in various avenues, but that's great. But my real joy comes from seeing people that I've helped and that I've brought up be successful. And yeah, the concept of evil, for example, applies in other organizations in various ways. And the next one was the one that I personally experienced, and I really enjoyed that. But my greatest joy was seeing others go through it that I helped. But I'd say my greatest achievement was having, I think it was about 92% of my sales force make it to President's Club. That's something I'll remember forever. Right? I kind of look at that and look at the number of promotions that I've been able to support. Yeah. And I suppose, you can ask any of them, you can speak to Sarah, one of the account managers in our group. She came up and led the account management group for NetSuite across APAC. And, she's probably one of the best customer success leaders I've seen. Yet I gave her one of the toughest interviews and for her to earn her promotion. And she'll tell you, there's no way that I could get given to me. And so, these people earned their success and I played a part in that. And that means more to me than my own success.
It sounds like something I came across more recently. And I think it becomes ever more apparent when you become a parent. And it's this thing around being useful. Nothing else really matters when you're trying to be useful to others. And it sounds like that's the philosophy that's shaped not only your life, but your career as well. What are your thoughts on?
There is a lot of that, right? And I think what tends to happen is we get myopically focused on what's the next step in my career. And so a couple of things happen, right? You miss the moment right now. And that could be a moment where you're actually in a really good spot. You're making decent money, you're learning a lot, you're making a big impact, and you're doubling your business. It's okay. Do it for an extra year or two, enjoy it. Yeah. It's the same with the kids, right? Go out and enjoy that. Go, you're really worried about the fact that, I'm sitting at 80%, I need to boost up, of course you do. But you know what? It's 7 p.m. Go and join your local sports club and join their committee. Go and, volunteer somewhere. Have a fulfilled, rounded life. And I guarantee, I promise you, it will make you more successful in your career if you have a balance to your life as opposed to being, just singular focused in that regard. You'll have a bit more fun too.
Fantastic. Vijay, you've been a fantastic guest. Thanks so much. Learned a lot. I know there's a lot of listeners that want to come work for you as well. So we'll look forward to seeing what the next businesses that you joined. So keep us updated. But again, thank you so much for coming on and having a chat with us.
No worries. Thanks, Andre. Speak to you soon.